Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine. I'm Jason Snell. Across the internet for me, it's your host. It is the chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Jason.
We're back. Woo-hoo. Happy birthday last week. So we took it off.
Yeah.
Took it all off. Even though.
Feeling every one of those years. 35 years.
Yeah. Wow.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is something.
Woo.
I'm not, you know, it's not, I'm no longer in my early 30s anymore. It's a difference.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You
know that.
Yeah.
You're like, are you mid 30s now too?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
Sure. You and me both.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Very, yeah, we got started young. lots of good stuff. This is I have to say, so we missed last week.
We did.
It was fine. It was your birthday. It was a perfect time to miss. But that means that this week instead of mm-hmm. last week is episode 80, Flash 80.
Flash 80.
The Jerry yes. Rice edition.
Into the Hall of Fame
of the TV Talk Machine. The goat. He's the goat.
He is.
The greatest of all time.
He's the greatest of all time.
Mhm.
That's without question.
People who don't even understand American football, just all you need to know, Jerry Rice, greatest of all time. That's it. Mm-hmm. Number 80.
That's it.
That's
just
it.
Like this podcast.
That's all you need to know.
Which might be our greatest of all time.
Like the greatest podcast of all time or just our greatest episode of all time?
Our greatest episode.
Okay.
It might be.
We saved up 2 weeks. We have 2 weeks of greatness.
We could do it.
Into this one.
Well, I am nothing if not an optimist. Everybody knows that.
All right. It's good. let's see. So there's so much here. I want to talk HBO a lot because that was, and I know you wrote about this a bunch because they're the individual shows and it was sort of like peak HBO. And all the premieres of their best shows all happened last week.
Yeah.
But I wanted to start with something that is even more important than the fate of one of the most notable TV networks around. And that is the fact that The Guardian UK gave a review to our podcast.
They did. Isn't that great?
Yeah. And I'm trying to think of what part of it we should like put on the like the storefront of the TV Talk Machine, like
uh-huh.
the big quote, because you get quoted a lot on, I would imagine, on DVD sets, on box sets, and things
yeah.
like that.
Uh-huh.
You get quoted. I saw that you were quoted not by name on one recently, just at The Hollywood Reporter.
Uh-huh.
That's all that's important.
That happens a lot, right?
But I think what I'm going to go with is does a good job.
That's a good quote.
Yeah, we do a good
does
job.
Does a good job.
That's right. Also, I'm not entirely clear that the person who wrote this write up didn't listen to more than one episode, but because they were talking about when we talked about Gary Shandling, but very nice. They all, you know, very nice for them to say nice things about us, because they could very easily have ignored us or said something mean, and instead they said we did a good job of separating the wheat from the chaff.
Yes, and it was in these times of confusion. They were tapping right into our mantra. Plus, it is a very large publication, very influential, and also it just reestablishes the fact that we are international, worldwide release.
Yes, indeed. Well, they get it. They get it the same day as everybody else in the world.
Exactly, and I think that they probably must know because you know maybe let's just be optimistic. Maybe they have. Listen to a bunch of episodes, and they do know that I'm a sucker for a British accent. That could be a thing.
They could.
I could have swung the vote.
But anyway, so our friend the Bottle episode, who binged like 40 episodes and stayed alive and is still listening, sent that to us. And thanks to the Guardian for is there a name? Did somebody actually write this? Oh yeah, Phil Harrison and Gwilym Mumford? That's probably Welsh, and it's probably like gum. But anyway, thank you to them. I don't want to just quote The Guardian like they quote The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you to the writers of the TV column for...
Yeah, they did a nice little roundup of different things you could do that week, listen to, and partake in, and that was good. We had a podcast to listen to, so I was happy for them.
Yeah. So apologies to all The Guardian listeners. We went out with American football at the top of this episode, but...
Yeah. They were like, you lost us. We're at the right at the top.
Gone.
Yeah.
HBO. So yeah, big HBO week, right? So you wrote about Silicon Valley coming back, about Veep season 5, mm-hmm. Game of Thrones came back, mm-hmm. And then you know, you wrote this piece about how why the return of HBO's best shows actually spells doom, which is, you know, you say you're an optimist, but
well, I don't write the headlines, but still, yes, they are so happy with me at HBO. And I can tell you that because of the repeated calls I keep getting to call them back and have a chat. Yes.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, it's not an unfamiliar position for me to be in when people are like, so-and-so calling for you, please call us back. And I'm like, I know what that is, and that's you yelling at me, and I don't have time in my day right now for you to yell at me. So generally I put those – I call them back, but in due time.
So I guess your point is these are all kind of older shows. They are all concentrated on the same – they're on the same schedule, so they're all premiering the same night. And that means a few things. It means there may not be anything waiting in the wings to take their place, and that when these shows go off the air after the next 10 weeks, what else is there? And that HBO's a little more precarious now than they've been in some time.
Yeah, they're just in an interest. I mean, I'm not saying that it's I think, you know, again, I didn't write the headline, so it's a doom. I'm not, that's, you know, but at the same time, I think the reason I wrote it was for two reasons. One, we live in a world now, and you and I have talked about this all the time, that's about bundles, and it's getting ever more about bundles and about what you want to pay for and cutting the cable cord and then creating these bundles. And we have done a number of minutes covering what we would do, what we would buy, what makes sense for people. So if you look at if you look at HBO in the same worldview as you do Netflix or Amazon or Hulu, something that you're going to buy, you know, it's all about what do you have. And right now, they have those three shows. And that kind of struck me as those are their best shows. And they all three aired on the same night. They all three premiered on the same night on a Sunday in a total running time of 2 hours. So
And then throw in John Oliver for half an hour and you got the whole bundle, right?
Right. But I was focusing specifically on scripted. And because, you know, yeah, people will want John Stewart, too. But if you're looking at scripted, the shows that there have two shows that are ending, and that's Girls, which, you know, it's not getting any new viewers, basically. You loved it or you didn't love it. It had a really excellent season this year. They got a lot of critical praise. People revisited the series. And you have Leftovers, another series I love, going into its third and final season, and no one's watching that one. So you have these two excellent shows, but they're going out. So the shows that you actually currently have that are actually of value, and I say that to distinguish it from, like, say, Ballers, which is a fine show, but no one's getting HBO for Ballers. Right. I can tell you that. Doll and M, that's a show no one watches. The animated series Animals, I'm not sure anyone even knows that's on there. And it's not really super great, and it's not a standout piece on itself because there's no other animation. The shows that people would actually pay to get are Game of Thrones, Veep, and Silicon Valley. And I gave very good reviews to Veep and Silicon Valley. Excellent reviews, rave reviews. I loved the first season 6 first series of Game of Thrones, first episode. So that was all good. But yeah, like, man, if you're selling, what you're selling is total running time of 2 hours, that's a problematic if you're going up against Netflix and you want my money. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of got into that just for scripted. You know, unscripted, you can add in, yeah, you could say, oh, they have movies and they have documentaries and they have all these other things. And, well, great. That's whatever. There might be a sports show you might like on there. And I certainly am a huge fan of Last Week Tonight, which is only a half an hour every Sunday. Still, not much to sell on. And so they're in a precarious position. What I say in the piece is that they won't be there for long. They have a lot of good stuff in the pipeline. And yet what I circle back to is, right, but Westworld and Vinyl were also in the pipeline. And that literally was the future. That was, whether they want to admit it or not, that was their 1-2 knockout punch. Westworld got derailed. It's currently, you know, not happening. It will happen at some time. I'll believe it when I see it. Vinyl, I came out and liked that show at the beginning. It got it got pretty good reviews, actually. It was like 79 or 76 on Metacritic. But as the season progressed, people were knocking on it, and I revisited it and showed all of its flaws. In fact, the whole "Can this show even be saved?"
Yeah, you wrote. Goes in. Yeah, you wrote that. That's a, you know, that's like you took the last episodes and you threw them down. You're like, no. Yeah. It's almost like it betrayed you, I feel like, because you were a big promoter of it, and then you didn't like where it went. So that's tough. That's tough, right? If that's one of the tent poles, and Westworld is just a mystery, you know, it's a big question mark.
Yeah, and honestly, no one is watching Vinyl. So it's an enormously expensive series. Like, oh my God, expensive, and nobody's watching it. And, you know, in my initial review, which was a pretty rave review, but I did have a lot of, you know, I had a little disclaimers in there, and I was like, if they don't do this, and if they don't do that, and if they stick to this, well, they didn't do any of that. They didn't do anything that I said stick to. They definitely did a lot of the don't do more of that. And so they found them. I had to turn on that series. I don't know if it can be saved for a second season. You kind of have to reboot it. So they're in trouble, hence the fact that my phone is blowing up. They want to talk.
Yeah.
But you're like, just dollars and cents. You and I talk about this. Just dollars and cents. You know, at some point, people are going to say, I don't know. That's not enough for me.
So, I mean, I've said this before. I have traditionally never paid for premium cable. And it was really Game of Thrones that pushed me over the edge, where I really wanted to watch Game of Thrones. You gave me those screeners to read at the very beginning. And it didn't even have special effects in them. And I was like, oh, and I got HBO, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I knew you would.
So it got me. And then... and then a couple other things ticked over, including them bringing on John Oliver, and that convinced me to just keep it and not do the old dance where after 6 months you drop it for 6 months and then you bring it back for 6 months, right? When the shows that you want to watch are on, and so I really feel this, like there is a level that HBO has to pass in terms of value for it to be worth it. And right now I look at what I'm paying for and it's a little unreasonable because I feel like between the podcasts I do, there's value in me having access to this stuff so I can talk about it. But like no normal person will probably want to pay for HBO or HBO Go or HBO Now and Hulu and Netflix and Amazon Prime and CBS All Access, and you know, you just keep on going, the new Turner thing that's going to be Turner Classic Movies plus the Criterion Collection, all of these streaming services, that it's only going to get harder to clear the bar of is this worth it. And to HBO's credit, they do seem to be building out their library a little bit more, realizing that their originals can't be enough. They actually need to build out an almost Netflix-like library of other material to make it have some value. And that's good, but still, in the end, if the only thing keeping me paying for HBO is John Oliver, I'm not sure that's enough, right? I feel like that makes that an easy decision over Netflix or Amazon.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. And you know, in that piece, which I would have people read because I think it's interesting in that.
Read
in
the
that
things. The links are in your podcast app of choice. Or for this one, you can go to theincomparable.com/TBTM/80, and there are links to all of Tim's articles that we talk about. They're always there, so you should. That's your homework. Listen to the podcast and read what Tim writes.
There's the homework.
Our covenant here.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, I tried to put in an anecdote that I thought would be interesting, and that was, and I think we've talked about it briefly here, was when I got called out from Showtime. They're like, oh my God, like you're down on our stuff. You're really down on our stuff, except for Penny Dreadful. And then I had just seen those two amazing HBO long trailers that the critics got, specifically long trailers on Vinyl and Westworld, and they look fantastic. And I usually do not get lured in by trailers, and so they wanted to like have some time. And man, they moved mountains, and we went down at lunch to have. I talked to David Nevins, who runs Showtime, and he just wanted a time to clear the air. He was not happy, I can tell you that. And he wanted to state his case. He thought that, you know, and in the end, you know, I think that they have a lot of shows on Showtime that are long in the tooth, stuff that I'm not interested in anymore. But they also have stuff that's coming up that could be good. And I do love Penny Dreadful, and Homeland had a turnaround season. And oh my God, if Roadies turns out to be better than Vinyl, then you've really undercut them. You know, so in a sense, he was right. So I wanted to have that moment in there to show people that, like, your fortunes can turn. And as much as I would like to give HBO credit and say, oh, look, they have these amazing things. You know, David Simon is doing a series about porn, you know, with James Franco, and there's all this amazing stuff that could be coming down the pipe. And but you can't count on anything in the pipe because it could come out, it could be Vinyl. So none of that was worth a penny until it becomes Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it's tough in this business, and I mean, you see this, and I feel for the executives in a certain degree, because it's development of TV shows is hard. It is, you know, it takes skill, it takes intuition, and it's also kind of a crapshoot at times. And so I can see how HBO's like, they got a plan. They're like, we got the next wave coming, but what happens when the next wave falls apart? Which seems to be the case with HBO. I feel for them. But you know, that's how it is. Like, if you can't get those shows out there, it's a tough business. But you can't expect your customers to pay for nothing,
right? And I would put this, I would add this, and this is something that's not in my story, and it's a little bit of inside baseball. But I think it's, you know, this is like bonus content for our podcast listeners, because I think it's important. But it was too convoluted of a concept to stick into that thing about HBO, and that is this: HBO has, for the longest time, under this new regime, which has also been around for a while, basically considered itself like, okay, we're HBO. You come to us. You come to the mountain.
Yeah.
And tell us, and we love you, and we love you already. We love your project already.
I love your show. Beautiful. You're beautiful. Yeah, we love
you're beautiful.
You.
We
Everyone
love
loves you.
You. Right. Exactly. Come on, Marty. Make us something, Marty. And everybody's good, and everybody comes. But the world has changed since then, and people are going to other channels. So in the meantime, the HBO phenomenon was, come to us, we love you, you're the best creators in the business. And I don't think they have experience giving notes. So that's my little tidbit I would throw here. I think they're a warm embrace place. I think they're a hug it out place. I don't think that they are like FX. And I know that David Nevins is very, very hands-on at Showtime. I don't know if the guys at HBO who do not come from a programming background are the kind of guys who give notes, because clearly Vinyl didn't have any notes in it.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it the celebrity aspect when you get Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger involved, or you know, any of these products that are really sort of like there's a celebrity director or some other kind of star at the heart of them? Is maybe that it too? Because like Game of Thrones famously had a bad pilot, and they said no, essentially, and said, you need to do this again, and they fixed it. But those guys were not stars that were running that show. But like Martin Scorsese, is there a reluctance? You want these star-led projects, but I wonder if they're reluctant once they wine and dine them and get them to do, you know, slum it on TV, that then they don't want to upset the apple cart, so they just let them do whatever.
I would be very, very surprised if Scorsese got a note.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And I will be just as surprised if Amazon gives Woody Allen a note.
Yeah.
So
yep.
those two things, I think.
Right. Which is fine as far as it goes, right? But in the end, if that's your strategy, is to just like give Martin Scorsese a blank canvas and cross your fingers.
Which is what they did, yeah. And I think if you go back now and you sort of reverse engineer the problems that Vinyl has, they're Scorsese's problems. So it's, you know, it's a problem that was created in that 2-hour pilot. So, or not pilot, 2-hour movie, basically. But yeah.
Yikes. I have a couple other HBO notes that I wanted to mention. I mean, when you talk about programming and the difficulty of it, the thing that came to mind is the old Mask scheduler wrote a post that I thought it made me laugh out loud, and it was an anecdote about pilot season. And about how NBC had so many pilots that they had like people, programmers, just like choose shows that they knew were not going to make it. And one of them was The Pretender, and they tested it last, and it tested it through the roof, and everybody freaked out because they weren't even gonna put it on the list of like things to consider. And it tested really well, and they're like, all right, well, let's test it again. They test again, it tests well again. And they, you know, they put it with two other shows on a Saturday night back in the days when they programmed Saturday nights, and, right. And it lasted like a few years, and was fine. And I bring that up, and I'm going to check the box here because I'm going to quote this, and I you got to check the box to do it. So, but this I think says it all about being a creative person and having to figure out whether a show is going to be successful or not. He says the moral of the story is who the fuck really knows? It's a crapshoot. After 1,000 words about this whole story, the moral is I don't know. Like sometimes I can see that. Like that's the scary thing is even if you think you know what the audience is. Are going to like even if you do as a producer or as a studio head as a network head have your finger on the pulse and give notes and all of that it's entirely possible that people are just going to reject it and you'd be like okay and then yeah. Something else that you don't have any thoughts about is going to be successful you know so I feel for them but it doesn't change the reality of it that HBO's cupboard seems kind of bare right now.
Yeah, and it's and that has been a no one knows if there was a recipe how to make this stuff people would have hits on every channel so no one knows it is a crapshoot that's mass schedulers totally on top of that
yikes
that has been my mantra covering this industry from the day I started
because
as soon as I found out that nobody knew what they were doing I was giddy I was like oh my god is that true. I love this place.
You figure these are the TV geniuses, right? They're the wizards. They know what goes on, and turns out no, not so much. And when somebody gets on a roll, I think they believe that whatever they're doing must be the secret. And it turns out maybe they were just lucky, and so they just keep doing it, and it doesn't work. And they're like, well, why doesn't it work anymore? It's like, well, maybe you were a little bit lucky too.
Yeah, I love all the institutional reasons why it doesn't work, and all the like historical things where like, oh, you are classically tripping over yourself by making copies of things. Oh, how many times did we copy Friends?
All right, I've got one theory for you though, which is I want to ask you. So if you mistakenly pick up that phone and HBO is on the other line, what are they going to say to you? Right, what do they have to say to you? Is it going to be, yep, you got us? or is it going to be, no, these shows are going to run forever and everything is going to be great? Or, you know, I just wonder how that conversation goes.
Well, I called Ben back because my theory is always I'm available. I'm not writing in a vacuum. I stand behind everything I write, so I don't have a problem talking to them. I've delayed calling them back for a couple of reasons, and this is also a podcast bonus, so podcast listeners can hear this. HBO are fucking whiny. They are whiny.
Box is already checked. You can't check it again.
They whine about everything. And it drives me a little bit crazy. It's like, oh, you know, you didn't put our third executive producer in there. Well, we don't do that. Can you do that? Can you make a change? Can you do a correction? I'm like, wait, do a correction to add in a producer who we don't normally wouldn't acknowledge anyway, just because their agents are calling you, hounding you that it wasn't in there. No, this is not what we do. So they have nickeled and dimed me to death on stuff like that. So I'm a little hesitant to call them back, but I did call them. And I think what they're going to say, Jason, my guess is, and I'm already prepared to shoot it down, is sometimes they just want to check in and like, you know, there's a feeling of like, have we lost you? Are you not quote unquote on our side anymore? Which is ridiculous, but this is a lot of times how people think. I think that's what Showtime thought when I went and met with Nevins. But I think what they were going to say is, my guess is they're going to say, okay, you wrote about this. We don't think it was fair because you didn't give us the breadth of what we offer. And I will say to them, I'm sorry that you're not a close reader and that the concept of the article is your scripted fare. And then there will be a long silence.
Yeah.
But like, what are you gonna do? I'm not gonna change my mind. I'm not gonna change anything. Everything I wrote, I thought out. Right. You know, so it's like, yeah, can they say yes, you didn't talk about like everything else we have? Well, no one buying that. And the whole article was about your scripted material. Because scripted is what I write about, and scripted is the heart of the content business.
Yeah. And on top of that, you are very much a let me see it kind of person, right? Mm-hmm. And so I get that when you talk about television PR, that because it's like this in technology too, right? There's a lot of hype and about, oh, this next thing is going to be great. And then there's the product. And like the product is what it is today. So for me, that'll be a computer or a piece of software. And they'll say, oh, yeah, but you won't believe what it's going to be able to do in 6 months. It's like, well, maybe. Although I've had a nickel for every time I've heard that. I mean, 6 months, there's a new product you have to buy that does what they said it would do. But I feel like that's the same with TV, where you know, you guys can talk about what you've got going on, but all I can judge you on is what I see, right? So if you've got something great in the pipeline, great. Can't wait to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But right, what is it? What is the state of affairs today?
Right. And it if I had a nickel for how many times, and people who know me, by the way, these aren't just, you know, I'm not getting called by the junior publicist. I'm getting called by the person who runs the whole place.
Sure.
And then they're going to try to patch me through. Oh, that's the other part of it. They'll try to want to patch me through to the executives. And I'm just like, this is not the time to talk to them. Talk to me when I'm in LA. It's not, you're not changing anything here. But if I had a nickel for every time they said, oh, yeah, so we got this coming up, you are going to love this. And people who think they know me have said that so many times, like, dude, you're going to love this. And I'm like, okay, sure. All right, let's see it. And then I'm like, not so much.
Yeah.
And that's happened at every place I've been to.
It's tough. But you know, and it's, I feel, like I said, I feel for them, but in the end that it's not your job to be sympathetic. It's your job to judge what is going on. Like what is the product that people are paying $13 a month or whatever for?
Right.
And is that a plausible product right now?
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, the good news is I read your Veep Season 5 review, and there was a lot of trepidation, right? Because Armando Iannucci is not running the show anymore. And he ran the show, created the show, ran the predecessor in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a great, put those two shows together. An amazing run. But he didn't want to do it anymore. Didn't want the grind of that. Wanted to do some other stuff. Brought in, you know, new showrunner, and that's the good news. Is it sounds like it's all cylinders, firing on all cylinders now.
It is all cylinders. And last Sunday's first half hour, I thought was like fantastic. It was a shotgun. It was a machine gun of great jokes. I've seen the first four. They're all very, very funny. The show is invigorated. I wouldn't say that like, oh, all of a sudden it's better. Because Iannucci is somebody I really like, and everything he's, you know, from most of the stuff that he's touched has been great, and certainly The Thick of It and Veep are Hall of Fame first ballot. But he's an amazing, amazing writer. He's really hard to replace. So it's really a credit to Veep that they did do such a good job of soldiering on.
And then on Silicon Valley, I mean, nothing so dramatic there in terms of just kind of continuing. And that's a younger show, right? It's only going into its third season. But your report on that is basically, it's still as funny as ever, but they still sort of, like Silicon Valley itself, they still sort of have the woman problem of not having many or almost any.
Right. They have two good female characters that at least one of them is getting a little bit more work, but they don't have a female programmer. I think they need one. I understand that they don't want to be sort of the, you know, they don't need to fix the industry because they're a fictional show. Silicon Valley should fix itself for starters. But my argument is always like they're expanding now because it's time that this, you know, Pied Piper is aggressively taking off. It's funded. It's expanding. They need more programmers, and I think one of those programmers should be a woman.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this last year, which is I know a lot of people who are women in the technology industry and really frustrated by the really incredibly bad behavior of men in the tech industry, and that's the problem I've got with what Silicon Valley has done is I don't want a woman programmer on the team for representative reasons. I want it for satire reasons because Silicon Valley, the industry is incredibly sexist and behaves so badly toward women. And I feel like Silicon Valley, the show, could just do a laceratingly funny satire about that bad behavior. I do wonder sometimes if they're afraid to do that because you do kind of want to like the characters on the show. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if they were unwelcoming to a woman programmer and were dicks about it, mm-hmm. I get how that might make the show a little more difficult. Like if you really undermine all of your other characters. And I don't want it to be an after school special, but boy, it seems ripe for satire and commentary about how badly Silicon Valley companies tend to treat women.
It does. And the point I make there and I've made before is that it's not to be representational. I'm not sure that is their job. It would be it'd be nice if they did do that. But also, I don't want just so exactly what you. I echo what you said. But what I've added is it doesn't have to be that. You can. It's really easy to put a woman in that position and then put another guy in and have the guy be the fall guy. So our core group that we like can have mild versions of, you don't want to make them unlikable. I mean, that is not like, this isn't a documentary. So you want your characters in your show to be likable. And they are likable.
Well,
that is what
Guilfoyle is there for, though, right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, he is meant to be kind of awful. So he can be awful, right?
Yeah,
he can be awful.
That's the thing. He can just be awful, like, a quarter of the time, and then you can redeem him. But it would be really easy to write in a new guy who's just a total dick, and then the giving it to the brunt of the woman, and then the guys, you know, are against him, but also sometimes for them, and then she calls them all out, and they all get scolded for their behavior, which is Silicon Valley typical. But your main people are not being harmed. My point is, there's ways around this,
right?
And it just to me is a missed opportunity for the staff not to have a woman on there. So it's kind of crazy.
All right. Well, it's a young show. They got a lot more time. So hopefully they will explore that down the road. But it's good to know. I mean, it's still funny. That's a very funny show.
Oh, it's very funny.
Spectacularly funny. Yeah. Moving away from HBO, you also wrote about The Night Manager, which I think we mentioned before because it already aired on the BBC. But you wrote about it on AMC. And you liked it, too.
I really did like it. And, you know, we reviewed that out of the Berlin Film Festival. So neither Dan nor I were able to sort of like... It was, you know, when it was super busy when it launched anyway. It was an insane month. But we both wanted to see it because we at TCA, we saw the extended 20 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever, and it looked fantastic. And it's got Hugh Laurie and Tom Hiddleston. So why would you not want to do that? And Olivia Colman, all so many great people who are on that. And I do like it. I really do like it. But I was trying to carve out a little bit of a place in my review, or not review, but like critic's notebook where I revisit it and say, yeah, it's excellent except when it's not. And no one really talked about when it was not. And I was like, boy, there's a couple of leaps of faith here that I struggle with. So it's like, it's almost coming to an acclaimed movie late and then saying like, what's the hubbub all about? This is pretty average. I think The Night Manager is gorgeous to look at, and I love it when Hugh Laurie and Tom Hiddleston are on the same scene, and even when they're not, they're amazing apart, particularly Hugh Laurie. But there's and then the visuals, it's like an international travelogue. The visuals are so amazing. But boy, it's got a lot of plausibility issues for me. Mm. And then I started thinking, oh, well, what about poor shows like Happy Valley, which don't have a hunky Tom Hiddleston to fall back on and are just going to go over this sort of bleak, foggy landscape of their home setting. And they can't be in, you know, all these amazing Mediterranean places and Switzerland. And they don't have these amazing big-time stars. Or you think about this Sundance miniseries I just reviewed called The Last Panthers. And that's like...
Right.
Really gritty and no real big stars in that, except for a couple, but they have really small roles and none of them are hot, you know? And it's like, oh, it's in, a lot of it's shot in the, Marseille section of France, which the first line is, uttered, ah, Marseille, the, gateway to Africa, asshole of France. So it's like, that's where most of it's shot. And then it's shot in a lot of, you know, places in the Baltics, which are grimy. It's not a beautiful travelogue series at all. And so these shows don't have that going for them. And I got a little bit persnickety because even though I like watching The Night Manager as entertainment, I can guarantee you that when Emmy time comes around, these guys are going to rack it up.
Sure.
And I'm not sure they deserve it. Mm. So that's my review.
It's fancy. It's fancy and British.
It's so. Like, oh, Tom Hiddleston. Woo. And then, oh, Mallorca. Wow.
I wanted to go back to HBO for a moment. I just wanted to check in on Game of Thrones. I mean, I feel like I'm reserving judgment because the first episode of Game of Thrones is always scene setting and table setting. We did we did our post episode podcast review thing on the TV podcast at the Incomparable, and all of us sort of agreed that it's like, you know, you can't, the first episode, it makes sense that you check in with like eight different storylines, but then you know, the momentum is very limited. We will find out. I want to believe I've got the poster, the Fox Mulder poster. I want to believe that we're going to see some real forward momentum this year because they are reaching the third act of their story. That we're going to really see them go in interesting directions. But that first episode didn't do a whole lot other than put the players back on the board and remind you who they are and perhaps what direction they're going in. So I feel like we really can't judge Game of Thrones. I'm glad that it's back, but
yes.
We're not going to know because this is the table setting episode, and then they're going to push it forward the next 9 weeks.
Yes. Hence the jokes about how long the previously on was.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, seriously, like every single one, the way I said it on the TV podcast was essentially you get a new set of characters and there are two things that happen. There's the reset and then they take like one step forward.
Right.
So there's slight movement, mm-hmm. but really it's about, hey, look, it's Jaime and Cersei and one step forward. Now let's move to Theon and Sansa and look, one step forward. Forward, and now we move on. So it's like just enough to like whet your appetite a little bit.
Right. Uh-huh.
But really, like there, what was it? There were several scenes that it was very much like, didn't we already have this scene last year?
Yeah. And it was like, remember us? Yeah. That's what it was.
Hey,
that
remember that Arya is blind and you know, she got in trouble with the faceless men. Yeah. Still like that.
Yeah, still like that.
Yeah, right? So we'll see. I'm excited that it's back. I really do
Me
like
too.
That show.
Me but. Too. It's funny. I always feel like, well, I mean, I got to hear your round table of Game of Thrones geeks taking apart each episode because my feeling is that I really love the show, but I do criticize some of the things, you know, on Twitter. I don't do a whole lot of reviews of it. I do love the series so that when it's finally time for me to like, just enjoy it as a fan. I'm like, yay! I'm all giddy that it's back. So it's I'm often less critical then because I'm just like, oh, good. I love this show, even though it doesn't move very fast. I'm just gonna absorb it.
Yeah, it's definitely the ones that we pointed out were first off, they spend a couple of scenes reminding us that Ramsay Bolton is an awful person.
It's yes.
Like, do you not remember that? Do you think
I was like, really? Do we need a reminder of that?
Anybody who doesn't know that? Right. And the other one that I liked is they go when they're looking for Daenerys, they're out in the middle of the just grassy area and they find the little like grass circle, like a crop circle where the Dothraki were. And Jorah Mormont gets off his horse and looks down at his feet and her ring is there. And it's like, I drop something that size in my front lawn and I take my dog for a walk and she poops right in front of me. And then I go over there with a bag and I'm like, I can't even see it now. But he out in thousands of miles of grass goes here. And then the first thing he does when he gets off the course is looks down and there's a ring there. I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was very convenient.
It made me laugh. It's fine. Whatever. You know, there's dragons too. Unlikely finding of a ring is not really high on the list of implausibilities, and yet.
Yeah, it is one of those moments that make you cackle. Yeah. I certainly did. I'm like, well, that was convenient.
That was easy, right? Yeah. I mean, they could have had him like looking a little bit, like one shot of him looking and talking and being like, ah, look at this. But no, it's just, it's right there.
That should have been a whole episode.
Yeah.
Just him on his knees.
Sure. Like, searches for a ring. I know it's here somewhere. No, it would be great. He picks it up and then he drops it and can't find it. Right.
Yeah, that's even better. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I laughed at my friend Rick Chandler when I was joking about how long it was that previously on. He's like, it was so long they actually need a previously on.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's like a TV show that does a flashback to things that happened earlier in the episode, later in the episode. It's like, I've seen that already. I watched it. Mm. It was this week. Yeah. Thanks for reminding me about something that happened earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You want to do some listener letters?
Sure, let's do that.
All right. So before we do that, unless you're going to Columbo me, which you're probably not going to do, I want to tell people about our sponsor. We have a sponsor this week.
Woohoo!
And it's Harry's again. It's our buddies at Harry's.
Mm-hmm.
I have their razor. I have their little shaving lotion that I really like.
And I'm fully on board now I've always been with the razor. And like I said, I can't shave with any other kind of cream than they're just their little rub on.
Yep, you've embraced the Harry shaving lotion.
Yes.
They liked the blades so much, like that famous story, but it's true. They bought the factory in Germany where they make these blades. So they're quality German blades, and because they are eliminating all the middlemen, they own the factory, and then they ship them to you on the internet, so there's no retailer in the way locking things behind a big plastic case. They can give it to you for about half the price of a big name brand that you would find in a drugstore. So you can save some money. You can get them through the internet, so you don't have to deal with people. I hate dealing with clerks at the drugstore. I just want to click buttons on my computer and have the product show up at my door. And Harry's is all about that. So that's great. Let's see, they have a starter kit that is that will let you get started with a pretty minimal risk, and you're going to like it anyway. For $15, you get a razor, you get three of those German blades from the factory that Harry's owns, and your choice of the shave cream or the foaming shave gel. You can take your pick. I was always a foaming shave gel person, but like Tim said, the shave cream, which is it's a little bit, goes on a little bit thinner. It's got this faint little mint smell. It's very nice. Mm-hmm. I like it a lot, actually. It's mm-hmm. it's quite pleasant. Instead of having the big kind of puffy, it's fun to have a giant foam beard, but it's not necessary, it turns out. Not necessary. But here's the best thing. If you have never ordered from Harry's before, that $15 starter kit, you can get $5 off. That's right. You just have to use the code TVTalk. And when you use that, you get an entire month's worth of shaving for $10. So that's pretty great. Harry's.com is two guys who are really excited about making a better shaving experience for everyone, and they're doing it now. You get a superior shave at an incredible price, and shipping is always free, which I really like, because I do try to mediate all of my shopping with a web browser instead of a checkout clerk, because I, you know, basically don't want to be around people, is what I'm
Me
saying.
Me either.
They're the worst.
So with you.
As Seinfeld taught us, people are the worst. So go to harrys.com now. They'll give you $5 off if you use the code TVTalk with your first purchase. That's HARRYS.com. As my in-laws would say, Harry's. because they pronounce Harry like he's a hairy fellow, and Harry as a guy named Harry differently. So HARRYS.com, TV Talk is the coupon code. You'll get $5 off the starter set, and you will start shaving smarter today. Thanks, Harry's, for sponsoring the TV Talk machine.
Isn't that nice? Thanks, Harry's.
Very nice. They're sponsoring it worldwide simultaneously, in fact. So, Dean in the 707 travel update.
Okay, Dean, bring it to us, buddy. Yeah,
Justified in Kentucky. And he watched the episode.
Oh, we have to. That was in a holler?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And we'll just say he was. And he watched the X-Files episode 731, which is set in West Virginia. While in West Virginia, he said there's slim pickings for TV set in West Virginia.
I've been to West Virginia.
Literally, we were on the highway, and we were passing between Pennsylvania and Ohio, and there's this weird little thing where West Virginia kind of juts up. There was a rest stop, and we just got off at the rest stop so we could walk around and say, hey, it's West Virginia. And then we got back in the car. So that's my whole story about West Virginia. It's a good story, huh?
Wow.
Yeah.
I love that. Okay. Yeah,
good All times. Right. Gary in the 510, five and dime, has some sad news for us, which is we talked about The Powers That Be, one of those shows that looked like it should probably have worked in terms of the people involved, but it didn't. And we said, you know, but it was a failure, and it, you know, it was one of those one and done kind of shows. Gary in the 510 says, no, it ran for two seasons. You're believing things your listeners say again. I'm so disappointed in you. Now, I will have you know, I fact checked Gary's letter. I went to Wikipedia and discovered that he is correct. I thought perhaps he was pulling my leg and giving us more misinformation. No, he's right. Powers That Be actually lasted 2 seasons. It's hard to believe, but it's true. So Gary, I'm chastened.
This makes me laugh. For some reason.
Well, just wait, because it gets better. Deb from the 607, the occasionally sunny 607.
Yes.
Says, I'm listening to your latest podcast while sharing Tim's insomnia on a sleepless Saturday night. I couldn't help but take pity for Jason's 2-week run of false facts. It's 3 now. Unlike Tim, who seems to take joy in Jason's being called out for sharing misinformation. I am here to offer my assistance. That's right. I hereby volunteer my services as a certified card-carrying professional researcher. I've worked for 30 years as a research and reference librarian and adjunct faculty member teaching graduate research method courses. Seriously, I got this. I'm online 24/7 and can turn around a research query in a flash. Never again will you feel embarrassed by those pesky little slip-ups. Forget Google and Wikipedia. Why risk your reputations by accepting erroneous facts from well-meaning but ill-informed Twitter people, when you can have your own personal reference librarian without leaving the comfort of your podcast? My research skills are smoother than a shave from a Harry's razor.
Very nice. Love her already.
Yeah, I would say that I really appreciate Deb's offer here. And the big problem with it is that it implies a slight amount of preparation on my part in terms of getting the letters ready. And the reality is I compile the letters approximately 2 minutes before we start the podcast. So, Deb, if I can get it together enough to send you some fact-checking with a little bit of a lead time, I will do it. But it seems unlikely. I wouldn't count on it. I mean, I'm going to start fact-checking our listeners, though, because I don't trust them anymore. That much is true.
I love that you were like, yeah. The only thing you didn't leave out of that was like, well, of course Tim thinks it's funny that I failed. Yes, this is what he lives to do.
It had just happened. Like, he was cackling moments before. So it was, she got it. She nailed it. She nailed it. All right, Marlene in the 5 and Dime. Okay. Wrote in. Another
one. Is it Marlene or is it Marlena?
Marlena. It could be. I'm going to say Marlene. Okay. Because she's probably not a German starlet, but you never know.
Mm-hmm.
After hearing the podcast, I want to urge both of you to finish The Magicians. It's much different from the book, but the changes make it better TV. It's very strong. The ending was quite unexpected. I'm definitely looking forward to next season. And I wanted to bring this up because I followed her advice, and I got back on the horse with The Magicians. I sort of stalled after about 3 or 4 episodes, and I can report back. I'm about 2 away from the end now, but I can report back. That is a show that just keeps getting better as the season gets along. I'm very impressed with it. Having read the first 2 books in that trilogy, I can say that the decision they made to kind of intermingle them has worked really well. I agree with her on that too. And I can't wait to watch the last 2 because I feel like it's just accelerating and they're doing a great job. So you liked the second episode better than I did, and I like the first episode but not the second episode, but you know, and then it struggled a little to get its momentum, but it did get it, and then I think it really killed it after that. So if people haven't checked out The Magicians or maybe stalled out after an episode or 2, I would definitely second Marlene's recommendation to go back to it. I've been very happy with it. I think they did a really good job. I think maybe I like The Expanse too, but I think that people who say The Expanse is the best sci-fi series of the last few years are maybe missing The Magicians now, because that's a good, it's not science fiction like The Expanse is, but it is a really good show. So good, full credit to sci-fi for putting on a few good new shows.
Yeah, I'm always happy to see a channel like get it together and turn around a little bit. It's always good.
Yeah, you're not against them. They just kind of fell apart, and now they're getting it back together. So yeah.
That's Magicians. What I try to tell people. I'm always pulling for you.
And The Magicians is a good example. I've been reading for The Incomparable. I've been reading a lot of the Nebula Award nominees for Best Novel. There's like 7 of them, and I've read them all in the last couple of months. And there's a lot of fantasy in there. And what it reminds me is a lot of the stuff we see on TV that's fantasy is very Lord of the Ringsy, high fantasy kind of stuff. And that's one of the things I really like about The Magicians, is it plays on your expectations that it's going to be that, and it's totally not that. And I love that, like throughout, that yeah, it's about magic, but it is not like, you know, people in big like robes with pointy hats. Totally not what that show is. So
yeah, it's not that.
Design Geek Jess from the 617.
Woohoo!
Says soon to be from the 415. I know.
Oh, okay.
So one, thanks for the push to go back to Breaking Bad and fight past my initial reaction to stop after episode one. I'm currently approaching the end of season three and loving it.
Yes,
sounds like my reaction to The Americans. Similar kind of thing. It's like, you know, trust me, keep going. And it's like, yes, all right, got me.
Did you like what I did with Yes, Jess? That's a good campaign slogan too.
Sure.
Yes, Jess.
Some exclamation points in there. Number two, as I choose where to live in the 415, are there any TV shows I should watch to experience the different neighborhoods of the 415? Well, there's Full House, clearly. That's real.
can't afford that.
The Streets of San Francisco.
That's a classic. Actually, anything that she will watch, she won't be able to live in.
That's true.
Actually, the last, I would just to be actually informative, the last show essentially based in San Francisco that was actually shot here extensively was Looking on HBO. Oh, so yeah. You can look at that, and that's, you get a pretty good sense of that.
And beyond that, it's like Nash Bridges.
Yeah, that's not good.
You can look at Monk, but you'll have to live in Vancouver and it's a long commute.
Yes. She's going to go, you know, this looks like nothing like Vancouver.
Yeah.
Or San Francisco. But I do love Vancouver too. Not to slight.
No, it's great. It's just, it's a long way from there to here.
And we're sunnier. So, well, you know, Jess, Jess must have cashed out a bunch of her Apple stock if she's moving to San Francisco.
She's going from the 617 though. So that's from an expensive place to an expensive place.
Right. That's true. Okay. And she's a design geek. So,
and her number three is, when was that 415, TV talk machine meetup going to happen? And the answer is, who knows?
That's totally going to happen. Yeah. It's totally going to happen.
We just have to pick a location and, pick a time and give it enough time for us to send out the worldwide signal for people to come and join us. But we can make that happen.
Yeah. We can make that happen. Yeah.
I'm sure.
And you know, people, you come to 415. We'll have a drink, but you know, come on. Anybody who's here, we drink with, basically.
Sure. We just need to pick a place and a time and show up.
That's usually the problem.
We could do that. Mm-hmm. We could do that. The question is, do we want to? Because I looked into it a little bit, and the question is, do you want to try to get a venue, and that gets problematic. You're reserving a space and all that, or do you want to just pick like a bar or someplace that's got like that's spacious, like, you know, like some brew pub that's got a, you know, enough space that you're probably going to be able to do it, and we just have to figure that out.
Right. Because we had a little fallback when we were at the 21A.
Yeah, we could go upstairs at the 21A. Which we did. You had a little in on with Sean from the 21st Amendment.
Because we need space, because it could be five people or it could be more. Yeah. So who knows?
Yeah, who knows? All right. Well, we're talking about it. That's the thing. Keep bugging us about it, and we will eventually relent.
And let us know where you live. Not that we're going to try to stalk you. Just let us know where you live.
Yeah, I have fond memories of the old TV Talk Machine meetups that we did. At the Cerrito Speakeasy, and that was good times.
Yeah, people always trip out like you guys, like, I'm like, dude, we're just like people. Yeah. We're not stars. I mean, Jason's
we're
a star.
We're robots.
We're robots.
We're just people. We're humans.
We can be just as boring in front of a drink than we are behind a microphone. Ba-dum-bum.
We can be boring and pedantic.
Pedantic and boring.
Jonathan in the +44, so from the UK. What is your favorite TV theme tune or music from a TV series, and why do some TV programs not bother with good music? For example, can you remember the music to Mr. Robot? And the answer is yes. Actually, the Mr. Robot soundtrack is pretty awesome.
Yeah, you should check it out. Where is my mind?
It is actually pretty great, like electronica from Mr. Robot. But Jonathan says, my favorite's MASH, Cheers, Hill Street Blues, 30-something, The West Wing, which is very minimal. Sons of Anarchy and Justified. You have any favorite TV theme songs?
Rescue Me.
Oh, yeah.
That's a favorite. The Vaughn Bondies. I like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Sure.
How can you not laugh at that? I like You're the Worst.
You're the Worst. I was going to say that is one of mine right now, current favorites. Yeah.
Slow Thrust is a great band.
So, and that song gets stuck in my head. That's so good.
Yes. That's so, I like them. I love that band. Both versions of Ed, which was the first one.
Foo Fighters.
And the second one, was Clem Snide.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
And Moment in the Sun, Clem Snide. I actually would probably be one of the rare people who liked the Clem Snide song better than the Foo Fighters song.
Yeah, but I like the Foo Fighters song better, but that's okay. It's all fine. It's all good.
So there's a lot, usually if it involves some kind of music song that's from an actual band, I kind of like it better. Yeah,
that's true. In terms of the orchestral stuff, I actually really like the Game of Thrones theme. I think it is super catchy.
Oh yeah, I love the Game of Thrones theme.
And
yeah,
there's a chiptune version that I actually use for the theme song for the TV podcast we do about it. That is really great. Little video game version of the game of video. I think it's called Video Game of Thrones. It's great. But that's a really catchy, like traditional orchestral theme song that I think is really good, and they mix it with that really cool opening sequence with the little model cities that you're flying around on the map.
Well, let's not
very nice.
Yeah, I love that. That intro is probably my favorite intro in all of TV. And speaking of that, just quickly, I got two things to say. As far as visual intros, the Night Manager is spectacular. Oh. I love that little minimalist. They did such a catchy thing, very short. But songs, let's not forget the theme song to It's Gary Shandling Show.
Sure.
Because it's Gary Shandling Show.
It is the most meta of all yes. theme songs. And it's true, some TV programs don't bother. The idea was that you wanted to get to the content, and it used to be like a show was 53 minutes long or something, and now mm-hmm. it's like 42 minutes long. So they're keeping their content and getting rid of the music. But even then, you can have, you know, a logo and a little tiny theme tune, and sometimes that's all you need. I think if you want to take the time, it's great, and some shows do, and then some shows don't, and that's fine too.
I would argue that probably the best stuff happened in the 70s, you know, growing up.
Yeah.
Like Sanford and Son and
The Rockford Files.
Rockford Files, yeah.
Love that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, check out if you haven't seen the Rockford Files opening, yeah, check that out on YouTube. The beauty of it is that like everybody, there's a different answering machine message left for him every week.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kick into that Mike Post, Pete Carpenter, who went on to do, you know, the A-Team and Magnum PI and Hill Street Blues, I think, is them too. So,
but I'll put Rescue Me up there with anybody.
Hmm. That's good. Mm-hmm. I think
that
yeah,
gets my blood
you're the worst. You're the worst. I love
that song.
That's
so
the
good.
Best.
Yeah.
You're the worst, and it's the best. Amazing. This one's from Yehuda in Israel, +4 mm-hmm. one.
Okay.
I noted that neither of you seem to be watching Billions, whose season finale just aired this week on Showtime. Somewhat of a soap opera of the rich and crooked, I could watch anything with Paul Giamatti, and Damian Lewis is nothing to sneeze at. Mm-hmm. So any reason Billions was passed over? See what I did there? Because it was Passover on the TV talk machine. Any thoughts about it? I just have too much TV, and it just didn't jump out at me. So that's my reasoning. Any reason why you passed on Billions?
Yes. I thought that the pilot was mediocre, and the two gentlemen who created it were not nice enough to not take that too personally. even though I did hear from them too back at and they were big fans, and they said, "Ow, we are big fans." And so that hurt. But I do like them. Dan reviewed it, so it for starters, it just fell behind because I wasn't reviewing it. I didn't have to watch those episodes. He gave it a kind of like a it's pretty good, it's not super great review, which didn't prompt me to then go seek it out. But I do want to catch up with it. I have heard thoughts that from people who did watch it all the way through, and most of it is in the it's pretty decent thing, and that I struggle with wanting to start something because there's so many great shows I haven't started with.
Yeah, that's too much TV, I think, is one of the reasons. But I'm glad that Yehuda found it and liked it. That's great.
Yes, I think that's good too.
A lot of good stuff out there. Just because we don't talk about it doesn't mean it's not good either. There was a time when that might have been the case, but that's not the case anymore. There's a lot of great stuff that I know I'm not watching, and I feel bad about it. But I can't even keep up with some of the good stuff that I already am watching. So
right, exactly.
Like, I mean, the Magicians came at the expense of like Daredevil, which I'm trying to finish. So I'm like, no. Now I'm on. This is how bad it's gotten, Tim. I made a to-do list for television where I'm writing down the shows that I want to be sure to watch. So when I'm sitting there in front of the TiVo, I can look and say, oh yeah, here are the things that I want to prioritize. It's gotten to that point now where I feel like I need to actually have sort of a system for choosing what to watch because there's so much on.
Yes. It's sad. Yes. Mm-hmm.
But this is the world we live in. This is a good one. This Joe from the Plus 6-1, Australia. He's in the O3 inside the Plus 6-1. That's Melbourne. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Hello, hello. Love caller. That. Right.
My question's about binge watching. It seems to have been recognized as a phenomenon that developed in the last decade or so with the advent of DVRs and streaming services. Not to blow my own horn, but I distinctly remember watching 13 episodes of Saint Elsewhere on Christmas Day, 1986, that I had taped on VHS during the year. In light of the new binge watching world record, 94 hours, set last week, I would like to ask both of you, what is the longest binge watching session you remember undertaking? And what show is it? Now, I'm a fan of the slow binge, so I'm not sure I have a good answer here.
So what are we fast binging first?
Yeah, I think that's what's the longest binge that you've done of a show. I imagine you would have to do that for your job, right?
Yeah, sometimes. I have to do that a lot. So I would have to break that into willingly fast binging it or unwillingly fast binging it, which is I felt like I had to really, and I'm going to restart that now with Bloodline on Netflix. I felt like I really had to catch up. I would say the longest I willingly and then enthusiastically embraced the long binge was Sense8.
Yeah. That's a Netflix. Good one.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the ones that I go through in like seconds that I joyfully and gleefully do are Catastrophe and Casual on Hulu, Catastrophe on Amazon, and those. So those ones I can go through pretty quickly, and I just, it's a little bit more of a labor to go through Happy Valley because it's so depressing, but it's so worth it. So that was a recent one.
Yeah.
And I rather joyously went through second season of Mozart in the Jungle.
Oh, nice. I would say the first season of Kimmy Schmidt was the one that I feel like we sat down for that on a maybe rainy weekend. And unlike a lot of these shows where it needs to be kind of the night and the kids need to be away somewhere, Kimmy Schmidt was good enough that we were watching that like one afternoon on a weekend. And lots of episodes went by.
Right.
Just kept on going. Because again, kind of light and fun and not making you feel like, oh man, I got to take an emotional break here. And so we just kept rolling with it. And that was actually a lot of fun to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's always great. I would say this, it's very obvious. It's always great when you find something that you want to binge and you just can't get enough of it. But I don't find there's a lot of that I want to do that on.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that. This is a good one. Donnie in the 206 wrote in to say, what are your thoughts about the financial failure of Louis C.K.'s new show, Horace and Pete? He said the show didn't meet expectations and left him $1 million in debt, and it won't be returning for another season. What do you think of his business model? I sent him a link to the Vulture story about this that I thought was very good, which is basically it was only ever going to be one season and he's going to make his money back and probably then some because he owns it all and TV has a life beyond its initial release. I thought that was really good. Joe Dalian wrote that story and it was really good. It's like, don't feel too bad for Louis C.K. He will probably be just fine.
I don't think that there's any doubt that he's going to be fine. I think that even if for some reason he couldn't, if he didn't have an apparatus that could recoup this money, he could make it all back again with stand-up comedy and all these other things, pretty simply. Beyond that, the Vulture article hit that, dead on. He's in the hole now. He will come out way, I guarantee you he'll come way, way ahead.
Yeah.
At some time, because I think Horace and Pete's going to do really well.
This is how the entertainment industry works, right? Is you put in the money up front, and you lose the money up front, and then you make it back. Like most TV shows lose money until the long game, and they end up making money. And I don't see how this is any different other than that he's a guy putting in that money up front instead of a big corporation that's got all sorts of different revenue streams.
Sure, it came out of his pocket, so that's the thing. And look at it this way, I'm not sure if I just skimmed that Vulture article or
it was a while ago. It was a couple weeks ago.
But you have to remember that even just anecdotally, almost nobody knows about the show.
Yeah.
So when they find out about it, like now you think about like on a Netflix, and it could still be sold to Netflix, by the way.
Well, that's the thing. And he owns 100% of it, right? So he sells that to Netflix. He gets the money or Amazon or if FX wanted to show it or if, or if HBO wanted to put it on HBO Go and promote it, whoever wherever it goes next, there's going to be, somebody's going to write a check, and it's going to not go to a company that will then pay Louis C.K. his royalty. The check goes to Louis C.K. He endorses it, goes down to the bank and deposits it. It's all his.
Yeah, and not only that, it's those are not, you know, forever deals. They are re-upped regularly. Yeah. So he's going to make money many, many times over, and he's going to get, when you deal with Netflix, you're kind of dealing with a worldwide operation, but you do, even though they're worldwide, you still are going to get, you're going to get domestic and international sales. Yeah. You're going to get different paychecks for both of those, just like a book would get. Right. He's going to make money back. And I think it was well reviewed,
especially, right? I think he's going to make it back because somebody's going to want to put this on their streaming service and say, look, you haven't even heard that. Did you know Louis C.K. did this whole show? Well, now you can watch it.
Right, and there's certain people who are going to say, I didn't know that, or yeah. I did know that, I've been waiting to get to it, and now I'm going to pay my money. Or they're going to say, I did, and I just, or I'd never heard of it, but I love him. It's the word of mouth, once it goes out, it's going to be huge.
Yeah, I think so.
He'll make his money back. And it's not a failure. It was only intended to go one season.
The only thing I would say that beyond this a little bit is that, you know, he just used this direct model and put it up. And I think he wanted to have the experience of, what if we made a show every week and it was like on that week, and it was like live theater except using the internet. Mm-hmm. And he got to experience that, and it cost a lot of money, but he also got to have that kind of like putting topical references in every week and all of that for the people who were watching it live. They got to experience that like as it happened every week. But a model that's very similar to this, but not quite the same, is the Kickstarter model, where you get the funding up front. It's not that different in some ways from what people did here, which if you bought every episode of Horace and Pete, you essentially paid Louis C.K. like $30-$35 up front for that season. And then in the end, he can now take it and sell it other places and make and recoup more of his money. The Kickstarter approach, you pay the money up front and you get the episodes too once they're made.
Right.
Mystery Science Theater 3000 is doing this. They funded 14 episodes of that. Joel Hodgson did on Kickstarter. I backed it because I always love that show. But you know, he's shopping it, and it's going to go somewhere. Like, it's going to be on a streaming service or a TV channel somewhere, and it's part of the big picture. Like, the people who funded it are going to get their downloads, but the difference is that before they even start making them, they're going to sell it into ancillary markets, and that's what's going to allow them to do it without going millions and millions of dollars in debt. And the difference here is Louis C.K. didn't want to do that. He wanted it all up front. He wanted the show up front. And so it's going to take him a little more time. But, you know, in the end, I think in both cases, the shows are going to be fine, and the people who, you know, people who made them are going to, you know, get paid.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I agree.
All right, we got some quickies from Twitter to close out.
Okay.
Matt in the 801 says, what is the point of Hulu? I haven't found anything worth paying for on Hulu in a long time.
Wow. Downer. Downer, Matt.
They got some originals. They got the James Franco, Stephen King one. They got some other good stuff.
Yeah.
Although one of the big things, one of the appeals of Hulu is for cord cutters to watch network TV shows.
Yeah, I mean, that was its original purpose. It was the day after pill.
Yeah, exactly,
basically.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I have some friends who are cord cutters, and that's what they do.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people who they have cord cutters, and I know a lot of people who just forgot to record something, and they need to see it, so they go to Hulu and do it. But I think Hulu's putting a lot more money in their originals. If you go and find some of their originals, you'll be amazed. And wasn't was it Netflix that originally had the which was the streamer that had the great movie collection that's now going to be on its own
TC. That also is Hulu, the Criterion Collection.
Yeah, Hulu had the Criterion Collection for ages, and it was brilliant. And so that was, to me, was like, that was worth everything when they had, I mean, they didn't have the whole thing, but they had the Criterion Collection was on there. So that's amazing. Go listen. I would tell Matt, it's Matt, right? I would tell Matt, like, go find, go watch The Wrong Man's, plural. I think you'll like that show.
James Corden. Yeah,
James Corden, and very, very good, very funny. Also, go check out Moon Boy, MOONE, which is also Hulu's original. They got three seasons of that, which was twice. It was my best comedy of the year. And, you know, I think if you look at, you've got 11-22-63, which is James Franco, and Stephen King, and now you've got The Path, which I really reviewed that positively. I like The Path. They're moving in that direction. Good things are happening.
Yeah. All right. One last one. It's from Biso on Twitter, who says, "Jason, I've been thinking about writing plausible but untrue emails to DVTM to see if they get read out." I don't know what to say to that. Bring it on. Bring it on.
Well, we have a fact checker.
Yeah, that's right. You are battling with our new fact checker.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can run it by Deb from the Occasionally Sunny 607.
Where is that, by the way?
And see what Deb says.
I need to find out where the 607
is. Well, I would have to ask my researcher, Deb, in the 607. It's New York.
Oh, okay. You know what? Just so Deb knows, in the old TVTM, we wouldn't even have looked it up. We wouldn't even have Googled it. We would have just said, "Deb, find out where you live and remind us."
It's in upstate New York. It's like Oneonta and Ithaca.
Oh, okay.
Binghamton.
So near the capital.
Yeah, a little over from Albany. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've been to Oneonta. I've been
really?
When I went to the Baseball Hall of Fame. See, we're ending. Oh. Started with football, ending with baseball. Baseball Hall of Fame is in Cooperstown, but there's nothing in Cooperstown. So we stayed in Oneonta.
Wow, we have lost the entire international audience.
Sorry, international audience.
Except for Canada.
All right, let me give you the numbers then, and you can send me facts that are false. How about that? podcast@tvtalkmachine.com or on Facebook, facebook.com/tvtalkmachine, or you can just tweet at us at TVTM. I am Jason L on Twitter. Tim is Bastard Machine on Twitter. And you can get the show notes, of course, theincomparable.com/TVTM/80 with all the links to all of the things that Tim wrote over the last 2 weeks.
Nice.
Anything else?
I think that's it.
All right. We did our job, or at least some approximation of it. Thanks to everybody out there for listening. We're glad you're back with us after 2 weeks away. And we will see you next week. Thanks, Tim. Have a good weekend.
You bet. Thanks very much.
Bye, everybody.